The land, for the new workers, was merely a thing to be worked, and with their machines they worked it as though they intended to turn all the irregularities of nature into straight lines or graded curves. One day I saw a heavy, wide roller being pulled by a tractor through a field of young grass, already fairly tall, though, and succulent-looking. The roller appeared to be breaking the stalks of the grass and creating, as if spectrally, the effect of a striped, two-toned lawn. What was the point of that? The young man I asked seemed bemused. Perhaps he hadn't understood what I had said. He mumbled something which I couldn't understand, all his style breaking down at this moment of speech, and making me think back to the strangled speech like gruff throat noises of Jack's father-in-law, "Dogs, dogs, worry pheasants." Even when what the young man said was made clear to me, it didn't make sense. The stalks were being crushed, he said, to encourage stronger growth. Another man said, on another day, that the point of the roller was to press down the Wiltshire flints into the ground, so that when the time came the grass could be cut without damage to the cutting machine. "One Wiltshire flint," he said, and the flints of Wiltshire and of the downs of my daily walk were given an importance and malignity I had never attached to them. "Could do thousands of pounds worth of damage to one of these machines." One new machine in particular, I noticed. It made great rolls out of hay. Great Swiss rolls of hay, as it were. These rolls, too big to be lifted or unrolled by a man, were man-handled by another impressive machine, a machine with iron grapples like giant scorpions' tails. A store of these rolls, in two layers, like a store of hay against some epic winter, was established far from the old farm buildings in an unfenced, flint-rubbled valley off the Droveway, just below the hill with the larks and the barrows, and from the top of which you had a sudden, near view of Stonehenge. So there were three stores of hay at different places. The Swiss rolls here, the golden rectangular-sided bales in the new hay shed at the edge of the old farmyard, and the bales, also rectangular-sided, in the rotting hayrick halfway down the straight stretch of the Droveway. What was the point of the Swiss rolls? Was there an advantage over the traditional bales? I never knew until years later, when this section of my life was closed. The bales, tightly banded by the baling machines, had to be broken into by hand and then spread out for cattle. The big rolls had simply to be unrolled. A machine did the job in minutes. Such refinement. But perhaps the scale for farming was wrong. Perhaps time should never be as valuable as that, day after day. Perhaps when routines became as tight as that, they could too easily go awry. One broken link, and human ventures were always liable to error, could throw the entire operation out of true. Everything the new farm did was big. A very big silage pit was excavated at the bottom of the hill, just across the lane from the windbreak and not far from the cottages. There was only one old-fashioned aspect to that silage pit. It was covered by black plastic sheeting, and the things used to keep the plastic sheeting tight and in place were the things that in my experience had always been used for that purpose. Old tires. They were bought in enormous numbers. Scores and scores of them must have been used, and scores of them were about, at the bottom of the valley, in the Droveway, just across from what used to be Jack's goose ground. Those tires, and the deep new silage pit with its braced-up wall of timber planks, and the banks of rubble from the digging for the pit, and the dark brown silage additive trickling out at the bottom, gave a touch of the rubbish tip to that part of the Droveway where, when Jack lived, geese and ducks wandered about. With the old farm workers, the first caution with strangers, the sizing up, was followed by a dumb friendliness, the country sociableness of people who spend hours alone in the fields in their tractors. The new workers, who were like city people in the country, city people in a larger workplace, didn't have that kind of friendliness. They hadn't come to the valley to stay. They saw themselves as people with a new kind of job and skill. They were almost migrant agricultural workers. They were people on the move. Quite a few came and went. I never got a smile from any of the people who moved into Jack's house after Jack's wife had left. She had said of the first lot of her new neighbours that they were snobbish people who were interested in lawns and horses rather than old-fashioned cottage gardens. After some comings and goings, people who fitted that description settled in Jack's cottage. His greenhouse, the one bought as it seemed from a catalogue and once green with hanging plants, was empty, its glass murky with dust and rain, its timber frame weathered. One day it was taken down, revealing the concrete foundation or floor. The elaborate garden, with all its time-eating chores, was flattened. What was left didn't need much attention. No bedding out plants now, no forking over of the ground below the hawthorn tree, no delphiniums in the summer. The garden was flattened, all but two or three rose bushes and two or three apple trees which Jack had pruned in such a way that they bunched out at the top from a thick, straight trunk. And the ground was grassed over, the hedge once tight at the top, mud spattered and ragged at the bottom, a half or quarter barrier between garden and rutted farm road. The hedge began to grow out into trees. Now more than ever, the cottages appeared to have neither front nor back, and to stand in a kind of waste ground. It matched the people and their attitude to the place. It matched the new way of farming, logic taken to extremes, the earth stripped finally of its sanctity. The way the pink-thatched cottage on the public road, once pretty with its rose hedge, had been stripped of its atmosphere of home by the people who looked to it only for shelter. But that might have been only my way of looking. I had known, for a short time, the straight stretch of a droveway open and unfenced. It had been fenced down the middle in my first year, and had remained fenced. But I carried that earlier picture. I had arrived at my feeling for the seasons by looking at Jack's garden, adding events on the river and the Manor riverbank to what I saw in his garden. But there were other ways of looking. Jack himself, giving the attention he gave to a meaningless hedge, a hedge that ran down the length of his garden and then abruptly stopped, saw something else, certainly. And perhaps the young children of the new people in Jack's cottage saw differently. They went to a junior school in Salisbury. The afternoon bus bringing them back set them down on the public road. Their mother picked them up in her car. Often on my afternoon walk, I had to stand aside on the paved lane to allow the mother's car to pass. She never acknowledged my stepping aside. She behaved as though the lane were a public road, and her car had the right of way. And I also never took in or properly noticed what she was like. Her personality was expressed for me only in the colour and shape of her car, speeding up or down the hill, going to get her children, or coming back with them. I doubt whether any children in those farm cottages had been met like that off the school bus. What pictures of their time at the bottom of the valley, brief though that time was to be, would remain for them? What immense views, what a memory of emptiness down the vast droveway and over the flinty slopes of the downs. At the foot of the paved lane down the hill, across from the silage pit, there was a narrow, little-used track, overgrown, hardly showing as a track, that ran along a dip in the downs to a small abandoned farm building. Weathered, not very noticeable, something perhaps from the last century. In that lane one Saturday afternoon, when they were free from school and the bus, I saw the children from Jack's old cottage playing, like prehistorical children in a great solitude. But they were among the leftover tires of the silage pit. Certain ones had been turned into their toys, their pretend paddling rafts, and the whitening banks and mounds of excavated rubble sprouting scattered weeds, pale green with bright yellow flowers, and concrete blocks left over from the building. Friendship has its odd ways. I had thought of the couple who looked after the manor, Mr. and Mrs. Phillips, people in their 40s, as stern and self-sufficient, locked away and content in their manor job, and having a private and much less stern leisure life with old friends in a town somewhere. But then they developed a local friendship, and for some time I felt this friendship threatened my own life in the manor grounds. Across the lawn from my cottage, against the farmhouse wall of the squash court, not farmhouse, not squash court, against that wall with its studded mixture of flint, red brick bats and bits of stone, there grew three old pear trees. They had been carefully pruned and trained at one time, and even now the main branches, still pinned to the wall, created a formal effect, making the trees look like large candelabra. The seasons dressed these branches in different ways, and the view from my cottage was always rich. The trees bore fruit, Always a surprise, always seemingly sudden. But to me they were not fruit to eat, and only partly because the fruit belonged to the manor. They were part of the picture. In the great days of the manor, 16 gardeners looked after the grounds and the orchard, and the walled vegetable garden. So I was told. 16. How could anyone not, running a plant nursery, find 16 gardeners nowadays, or pay their wages? How different the hamlets and villages round about must have been then. How many working people in little houses. The cottage where I lived had once been the garden office. Now I, who did nothing in the grounds, lived there, and there was only one gardener. He had a system. He used a hover mower to cut the lawns, at the back and side of the manor and in front of my cottage, two or three times in the summer after a very low cut in the early spring. In the early spring he also laid down weed-killer on the drive and the old gravelled path around the cottage lawn, and on all those paths that had not been surrendered to grass. Once a year, in late August, he cut the tall grass and stalky weeds in the old orchard, wherein the hollow knots of untended trees nestlings cheeped in the spring, and the trees themselves grew on, flowering at the correct time, bearing fruit, dropping fruit, attracting wasps. In the autumn he had a great leaf-gathering. But his main work for much of the year was on the vegetable and flower garden, separated from the path at the back of my cottage by a high wall. The system worked. The garden had its wild parts, the water meadows were marsh, but elsewhere the gardener's attentions, slight but regular and with method, suggested a controlling hand. The gardener's name was Pitten. I called him Mr. Pitten at the start, and called him that to the very end. It was Pitten who, one year, talking of the pear trees on the farmhouse wall, gave me a new determinative use of the preposition in. The pears were ripe. The birds were pecking at them. I mentioned it to Pitten, thinking that with all the things he had to do he mightn't have noticed. But he said he had noticed. The pears were very much on his mind. He intended any day now to pick them in. To pick the pears in. I liked that, in. I played with it, repeated it, and though I don't believe I heard Pitten use the word in that way again, I associated it with him. Then, as the reader will learn about in more detail in a later place in this book, Pitten had to go. The manor couldn't afford him, and there were no more regular gardeners, where there had been 16. No one to look after the vegetables in the walled garden, or cut the grass, or weed-kill the drive and paths, or pick the pears in, or keep the branches of the pear trees pinned to the squash-court wall. The wind tore the upper branches of one tree free of the wall. The main trunk sagged forward, leaving a ghost-like outline in green-black on the wall. The branches drooped. The tree seemed about to break, but it didn't. The tree flowered, and at the foot of the wall in the summer, beside the path Pitten had once weed-killed, there grew up tall weeds that might have been chosen for their picturesque effect, shades of green, different degrees of transparency, different sizes of leaf. Above that, delicate white pear blossom turned to heavy fruit at last. The birds became interested. No one now to pick the pears in, officially. But then one Sunday, from my bedroom window, I saw a curiously dressed man looking at the pear trees, assessing them, and then, tentatively, picking the pears on the lower branches. Strange people came into the manor grounds at various times. Pitten, when he had been there, had let in certain people. The Phillipses, the couple in the manor, had their own friends and visitors, and there were certain odd-job people they employed. And very occasionally there were people connected with my landlord. The curiously dressed man was unusual, but I had no means of knowing whether he was a marauder, someone simply picking the pears, or whether he was someone who had authority and was picking them in for the use of the manor or people of whom the manor approved. He was curiously dressed, in army camouflage clothes, trousers, tunic, round-brimmed hat. The clothes didn't look like army surplus, or at any rate the stuff in the windows of the surplus stores. There was a quality of dash and swash in the cut, the camouflage pattern, and the muted colours, and, curiously, with the dressiness there was an element almost of disguise, which made the man seem dangerous, like an intruder. As he looked at the trees and with his tentative hands tugged at the lower pears, he turned from time to time to one side, his face still hidden by the camouflage collar and hat, in the direction of the manor courtyard, like a man nervous of being observed. But then, getting out the ladder from the garden shed, next to the squash court, the shed that had been Pitten's, placing the ladder against the wall, starting from the top and working methodically, carefully down, leaving nothing for the birds, bucket by bucket the man in army clothes picked the pears. And it became clear that he was picking them in, and that he was picking the pears of the old trees in because he had the blessing of Mr. and Mrs. Phillips in the manor. He had looked shifty at the beginning, uncertain, as though expecting someone to appear behind him. The person he must have been looking for appeared while he was on the ladder, because then, like a man apparently satisfied, he had concentrated on the pears. The person who had appeared was a girl, or rather, a young woman, and she was half familiar to me. She walked on the lawn and directly in front of my windows. The Phillipses never walked in front of my windows. They allowed me my privacy in the openness of the lawn. They were careful to walk on the far path, beside the squash court and the pear trees. This woman was going nowhere. She had come from the manor for a saunter on the lawn. She was short and heavy-hipped. Her tight jeans emphasized the slowness and smallness of her steps. She was like someone who had been granted the freedom of the grounds, and was at that moment beginning to taste the new freedom. She too was unusually dressed. The extravagance was in her top, a shirt with the tails knotted in front just below her breasts, leaving her midriff bare, not quite suitable at that time of year. She had been half familiar to me. Now I knew her. She was the woman I had seen sunbathing in the ruined garden of the thatched cottage. I had associated her so much with her cottage and garden and car and open front door that this sight of her in another, more open setting and so close to me was like the sight of a new person, and the man in army camouflage on the ladder was her farm worker husband. Here, on a Sunday afternoon, they were in the manor grounds, she strolling about the lawn, her hips tight in hard jeans folding horizontally and almost in a straight line into alternate lateral peaks, her husband picking pears, ripe fruit from old trees that might have been planted against the wall by the person who had designed the wall, trees once carefully tended and still, after years of neglect, showing signs of that early care. They, the woman with the midriff and the man in the army-style camouflage, must have attracted the Phillipses in some way. Perhaps the women had got on. Perhaps the men had got on. Perhaps the Phillipses were 10 to 15 years older. There might have been a cross-attraction of some sort. The woman with the midriff would have been important to the relationship. At any rate, the relationship between the four couldn't have existed without her support or encouragement. Already, and mainly from glimpses I had had of her in her ruined garden, lying on a cheap, aluminium-framed easy chair, I had wondered about this woman. She had given me the impression of being at the centre of passion, the cause of pain, a woman whose beauty caused pain to the man who at that moment was permitted to possess her, a woman who knew this. That impression, arrived at from a distance, was added to now by the clearer and fuller sight I had of her on the lawn. To the narrow waist, the full hips, the firm thighs and upper arms, the breasts, flesh without muscle, half revealed, half flattened by her sunbathing-like top, to this voluptuousness were now added the stare, rather than the fire, in her unsteady light eyes, the greediness expressed by her mouth with its seemingly swollen lower lip, and by the distinct spaces between her top front teeth. Her sexuality was precious to her, more precious than anything else. And here she was, in the grounds of the manor. And she was like someone in her own park, as though, just a few steps away from the clutter and constriction of the thatched cottage that had come with her husband's agricultural job, and which she couldn't therefore see as a real house, she had found a resort more suited to her style. She walked slowly up and down the lawn, as though making herself familiar with a new pleasure, and the man in the army camouflage stood on the ladder and picked the pears, keeping his back to her, not turning round to look for her, as though he was now content with his wife being where she was, with him. Perhaps they and the Phillipses had come together as town people, working in the country but separate from the life of country people, town people but servants, all four with their special style and pride, sharing now the grounds and privileges of a manor, offering and returning hospitality. I couldn't tell who out of the four was benefiting most from the relationship. The person with most at stake was Les, the farm worker, who spent hours away from his wife, in his own solitude, in his tractor cab, seeing the tedium of a particular job physically expressed in the extent of a great down, perhaps without trees or windbreak, moving slowly back and forth, his thoughts no doubt often going back to the woman in the thatched cottage. The grandeur of the manor, the grounds, the gardens, the river, these were like things he could present her with now, another side of what was to be found in the country, some little reward for the desolation of her life in that valley which others thought beautiful, and in that thatched cottage which others thought picturesque, but was picturesque only to people with another kind of life, different resources, another idea of what was owed them. I was nervous of Brenda. She had no great regard for me. She had her own idea of what was to be respected, and the way I lived, a middle-aged man in a small cottage, and the work I did, if she had found out, didn't fit into that idea. In this she was different from the Phillipses, who saw me as artistic, a version of their employer, and had always been protective. There was a difference of generations here, but it was this difference that, over and above common interests, lay at the heart of the relationship between the four. The older people glamoured by the style and boldness of the younger. Brenda was being groomed to serve in the manor when the Phillipses were on holiday, or wished to take a day off. They had been looking for some time for a suitable person, someone compatible as well, a friend, yet someone who would not be a threat. And the prospect of a part-time light job in the manor for Brenda, the prospect of having the run of the little wild estate, the gardens, the orchard, the riverbank walls, this bound the younger people to the Phillipses. And that took some understanding, that people like Brenda and Les, who were so passionate, so concerned with their individuality, their style, the quality of their skin and hair, it took some understanding that people who were so proud and flaunting in one way should be prepared in another corner of their hearts or souls or minds to go down several notches and be servants. They were servants, all four. Within that condition which should have neutered them, all their passions were played out. But that might have been my own special prejudice, my own raw nerves. I came from a colony, once a plantation society, where servitude was a more desperate condition. Les was under pressure, from his work on the farm, and his uncertainty about what was going to happen with that very big venture. If it failed, he would have to move on, find another position. From his obsession with Brenda, whose beauty so obviously tormented him, possession of the woman not enough, constantly reminding him of what he might lose. And pressure, too, from his increasingly dependent relationship with the Phillipses. He wished to keep the footing he had obtained in the manor. He wished Brenda, to whom it mattered, to continue to enjoy the freedom of the grounds. To do so he had to put himself in some ways in the power of the Phillipses, had to some extent, after the servitude of his own job, to serve them. He cut the grass on the various lawns, a big job. He made himself busy on Saturdays and Sundays with his hammer and saw, mending bridges over the creeks, black with rotting leaves, in the water meadows, keeping a path clear to the riverbank. He even tried to revive some of the vegetable plots of the walled garden. Between the paths, a wilderness of weeds in the old sifted earth, many times forked over and fertilized, but the garden as a whole still showing a fair amount of its original design, and, like the pear trees, preserving after many years of care something of its formality, even with the wire netting and coops and rough carpentry and basins. All the abandoned intentions of the various odd-job people who had worked in the garden and grounds after Pitten had left. Les worked on the vegetable plots in the evenings after his work on the farm. Energy. But this late work on the vegetables became an irritation to me. He used the sprinkler then, and the flow of water there set up a high-pitched vibration in the old metal pipes that ran through my own cottage, so that my cottage hissed and hummed while the sprinkler played. Pitten and his successors had used the garden hose, or sprinkler, during the day, but the noise then had been muffled by the noises of the day. In the silence of the evening, The old silence of the country, even with the electric light glow in the sky of the towns all around, a silence so pure that the trains going in and out of Salisbury Station, 6 or 7 miles away, could be heard sometimes when I went out of my cottage door. In the evening those hissing pipes could be clearly heard and couldn't be ignored. I did something I hadn't done before. I telephoned Mrs. Phillips at the manor to complain. I was expecting her to be combative and protective towards her friends. To my surprise, she made no fuss. She accepted what I said about the peculiar nuisance of the hissing pipes in the evening, and said she would go and turn the sprinkler off herself. She did that, and the abrupt silence in the cottage, coming at first like a ringing in the ears or the head, a noise of cicadas, was like a blessing. What accidents had given me my life in the cottage? What accidents protected it? How little it would have taken to alter the whole feel of the place and to drive me away. A disturbance like the sprinkler late in the evening, or Brenda walking too often outside my window, or too many strangers making free of the lawn outside, or too many parties and visitors in the servants' quarters of the manor. Mrs. Phillips had been cooperative, but I expected after this that there would be a certain awkwardness with her, and a more pronounced awkwardness, long building up, with Brenda and Les. And such was my mood, my acceptance of the inevitability of change, my idea that things lasted for their season, such was the effect of my training myself to say, well, at least I have had this for a year, and at least I have had this for 2 years, that I was half prepared to feel that my life on the estate had changed for good. But there was no awkwardness with Mrs. Phillips or Mr. Phillips, and no awkwardness at all with Les. In fact, Les, with whom I had so far had little to do, made a friendly move towards me, and he did so the very next day. At the time when the sprinkler might have been turned on, and from my kitchen door I might have seen the arc or fan of the parallel water jets, hypnotically appearing and disappearing, waxing and waning against the late southern sky, above the high wall of the vegetable garden, the wall that ran beside the little lane at the back of my cottage, at that time he knocked at my kitchen door. Technically it was a back door, but it was the only door I used to go in and out of my cottage. I saw him through the high glass panes in the door. He was bareheaded when I opened. His camouflage hat, a relic of the camouflage outfit, was in one hand, and he was offering some vegetables in a basin. The gesture of offering was graceful, classical, and he was smiling. The picture remained with me, the lean, sunken-cheeked, tanned face. The hat held in one hand, the two hands together, holding the basin with the vegetables. The smile. Yet what was also noticeable about him was his lack of beauty. And this was now noticeable because I had expected a man of good looks, from his physique, the way he carried himself, his clothes. His chin was heavy. His teeth were bad. They mocked his smile. His skin was marked. And yet he had worked hard at his looks. His hair was stylishly cut, soft, freshly washed. I understood now why he always wore unusual or elegant hats. They helped. From a distance he looked good in hats. I understood also a little of the anxiety I had sensed in him about Brenda, as well as a little more of Brenda's manner, the manner of a woman who was still owed a lot. When the Phillipses went on their holiday, Brenda took over at the manor. She moved into the Phillipses' quarters. Les stayed on in the thatched cottage. I had to be away for a few days at this time. On the morning after I got back, I went to the manor to get my letters. My letters were kept there when I was away. That was the arrangement with the Phillipses. I rang at the kitchen door in the manor courtyard. I heard music inside. Brenda was a long time coming. She would have been deep in the Phillipses' quarters. They had elegant rooms. They had a sitting room with a stone terrace leading out onto the back lawn, which had been laid out 50 or more years before, and had big trees and flower beds and old rose bushes and old pieces of garden statuary. In the distance, the marsh of the water meadows, the river, and the meadows and the down on the other bank. To this, on the stone terrace just outside, the Phillipses had added bird tables and pendant seed bells at which tits and other birds pecked. Brenda was carefully got up, jeans and blouse, her full lips painted, something done to her eyelashes, emphasizing the stare of her unsettling blue eyes. her appearance at the same time suggesting an immense idleness in the Phillips's quarters. Servant and not servant, and now not particularly attentive to me. She said she had seen no letters. At her back was the big kitchen of the manor, which, from what they told me, the Phillipses had done up, or caused to be done up. A warm, inviting kitchen with a big stove and many cupboards, thick walls, small windows set in deep embrasures, the electric lights on. A feeling of space and protection, of doors opening into corridors, and big room standing beside big room. Shortly after she came back, Mrs. Phillips telephoned me to say that there were many letters for me at the manor. When I went to her kitchen to get them, I told her that Brenda had told me there were none. Mrs. Phillips didn't seem displeased to hear this. No explanation, no comment, just a hint of a nod. She was like someone digesting a piece of news, adding it to what she already possessed. And I felt that Mrs. Phillips had changed her mind about Brenda, that once again, as had happened with other people she had tried out as her holiday replacement, Mrs. Phillips had found a reason for recoiling from having a stranger in her kitchen and rooms. Brenda might have been the central person at the beginning of the relationship between the four, but now Mrs. Phillips was more important. I was not surprised then when Brenda stopped appearing in the manor, but I was not prepared for the news Mrs. Phillips gave one day. "She's run off to Italy with Michael Allen," she said. Michael Allen was a central heating contractor. He was a young man with a newish business. He had profited from the old-fashioned ways of the older central heating and plumbing firms, used to dealing with big houses, used to being well thought of, but burdened by the expensive town centre premises and large staffs of older days. I had got to know Michael Allen after he had come to the manor to do something about a boiler that had exploded. I asked him about the hissing pipes in my cottage. He said in his brisk way that the only cure for that, as well as for other things in the manor, was to scrap the entire plumbing system, all those antiquated metal pipes. I remembered his confidence, the way he walked, the way he came into my cottage. He actually had a little strut. He was a country fellow and a great boaster. In the short time we spoke, he boasted about many things. He asked me nothing about myself. He employed 6 people, he said. He intended to retire when he was 40. In a bigger town, in London, say, people like Michael Allen do not really have personalities. Their personalities seldom make an impression and do not matter. They or their employees come out of the streets, do their jobs, and return to the streets. They disappear. They are hardly their names. They are more their telephone numbers and their bills. In a place like the Valley, the entry of the same kind of person into your house is more of a social occasion. He comes with more readable attributes and many more points of contact. His village or small town, his neighbours sometimes, his education, his background, the houses and people he has served, and the services and shops he in his turn shares with you. Michael Allen boasted. He saw himself as a man of energy and ambition, and for this reason untouched by the recession other people complained about. He saw himself as adventurous, several cuts above the general run of people who didn't have the courage or the spirit to go into business on their own and were content to be employed by others. His looks were passable. He had a moustache of the current fashion, but after that meeting I remembered more his absurd pride and boastfulness, and the strutting, almost hands in pockets, way he came into the cottage, as though he were doing it and me a favour. I saw his van sometimes in Salisbury. Once or twice I saw him and his van outside the Safeway supermarket. Michael didn't like that, being seen using his van as a car. I saw his van outside Brenda and Leslie's cottage, and in the courtyard of the manor. But that wasn't surprising. I was used to seeing his van, as well as the vans of certain local builders, up and down the valley. Certain tradesmen were never idle. But Italy? What old-fashioned idea of romance had sent Michael and Brenda there? What film or television show, or was it, more simply, that Michael had been there on a package holiday and felt safer with what he knew? But wasn't that going abroad itself a sign of the brevity of the passion? How could Michael give up his 6 employees, his local reputation, his van with his name painted on the sides and the back? How long before he wished to return not only to that fame and career, but also to his old life? And so it happened. Brenda reappeared. Not in the manor, That interlude was over. Even before Brenda had gone away, Les had stopped coming to the manor, had given up the vegetable garden, the hammering on weekends, the doing of odd jobs about the grounds. All that effort to put things right, all that effort of heart and hand had gone to waste. The manor had swallowed it up. Waste. But the manor had given things in return, had given pleasure, had given Les for many weeks the freedom of its wild grounds. Just as, before Les and Brenda had come to the thatched cottage, the country life and its seeming secrecy had given the dairyman from the town some genuine new idea of the beauty of the days. Now the manor was in the past, and Les had retreated to his thatched cottage, never romantic to him, and now no doubt the wretchedest of places for him, had retreated to the solitude and noise of his tractor cab going up and down the immense slopes of the downs, considering earth and dust, now black, now brown, now white, and the physical desolation of his fields. I had seen him at one of his best moments, appearing at the door with his vegetables, offering them with that classical gesture and a smile of pure goodwill, the smile of a man receiving at that time a little love from the person he loved, and passing a bit of it back to the people around him. For Brenda, that return, not just from Italy, but from Italy to the cottage, must have been awful. After half-queening it in the grounds of the manor, and queening it for a full fortnight in the quarters of the Phillipses, with that grand view from the sitting-room of the lawn, and statues, and old trees, and the river. She had asked for so much from her beauty. So much. And then she had asked so much again. Mrs. Phillips said of Brenda, "Michael kicked her out." And that was all. Michael. The use of the first name pointed to some new attachment on Mrs. Phillips's part, some new, or old, sympathy, something born of that town life, pub, club, or hotel bar, which at one time might have involved them all, Mr. and Mrs. Phillips, Brenda and Les, and Michael Allen. It was a good thing that the autumn was well advanced. No question now of Brenda's having to show herself to anybody, to prove that she was unabashed, and that life was going on. She could close her front door and stay indoors, just as Les could take out his tractor and hide behind the tinted plastic of his cab. The farming organization that had brought these town people to the valley, and had in their own way remade parts of the valley, was fading, for reasons I didn't know. With such ventures as it was with the military exercises on the ground or in the air that were so often with us, one saw a great deal, but understood little. Les was looking, it was said, for another job. Three or four times I saw Brenda and Les on the road in their little dark red motor car. They had taken down part of the fence and the hedge to make a space for that car in the garden, and the thatched cottage had indeed been no more than temporary shelter. To have invested more in it emotionally would have been a waste, more of a waste than Les's evening and weekend work in the manor grounds. The first time I saw them in their car after they had stopped coming to the manor, there was some kind of half-recognition from Les. From Brenda there was none. Perhaps there had been some trouble with Mrs. Phillips over my letters, the letters being put forward by her as a cause, and I had not been forgiven. On the later occasions I saw them, there was nothing at all. Our brief acquaintance was over. There was a van that I also saw, the van of Michael Allen, going importantly about on its central heating business, country town success. Michael had given me a glimpse of that side of things here. But Italy? Who would have associated romance with that van and the name painted on the sides and the back of the van, painted in three places? Whenever I saw the van, I thought of Mrs. Phillips's words. Michael kicked her out. How hard it must have been for Les and Brenda to live with those words, which others must also have heard. The days shortened. The way below the yews from the public road to the manor drive and to my cottage, that way was so dark at 4 in the afternoon that when I went shopping in Salisbury on the mid-afternoon bus, I needed to take a flashlight for the short walk back from the bus stop. Country darkness. Big things could happen almost secretly, and one such thing happened in the thatched cottage with a straw pheasant on the roof. It was Mrs. Phillips who gave me the news. She said, 2 days after the event, "Brenda's dead." She added, and it seemed calmly, "Les murdered her." murdered, the formal word, rather than killed. We use formal words, even empty words, when events are big. I thought of the way they had both appeared on the lawn during the pear-picking, two birds in bright plumage. I thought of the face of the satisfied lover, offering me the vegetables at the kitchen door, the gift of the happy man. Then I thought of Italy and the Michael Allen van going about its money-making business, spreading the name around, while Les was running about in his red car looking for a new job. So hard to contemplate the physical act, the setting, the finality, the body, just a few hundred yards away. I thought of the least intrusive question I might ask. Where did he kill her? Right in that cottage, on Saturday night. Saturday night. Was it a night of drink and temper? It wasn't what I associated with them. Mrs. Phillips said she taunted him. And taunted, I felt to be a technical word, as technical as murdered. It had sexual connotations. She, the Italian runaway, had done the sexual taunting. She had not come back abashed. She had done the taunting, the goading. How often, to punish someone for her Italian failure, she must have taunted him, and it was hard not to feel that she didn't have some idea of what she was provoking. And now, having started on the job of destruction, he had used a kitchen knife, having started on that from which very quickly there was no turning back, however much in a corner of his mind he might have been wishing it all undone, healed again, how he must have struck, until the madness and the life was over. All in that little thatched cottage with the ruined garden. Worker bees work till they die. When they die, other bees clear the hive, get rid of the bodies, because bees work and are clean. Even so, without disturbance, without many people knowing, even people on the bus, the cottage was cleansed and cleared of its once precious life, its once precious passions. She taunted him. It was the verdict, and all hearts were with the living, the survivor, the man, as, had it occurred the other way, they would have been with the woman. The police were discreet, hardly seen, almost as secretive as the event itself. More information was to be had from the local weekly paper than from immediate neighbours. They had seen very little and didn't want to blame one partner more than the other. Everyone drawn close at this moment to Brenda and Les, seeking to remember them and responding to this very near event almost as to a family tragedy. One local formality remained. Brenda's things had to be collected. And some weeks later, before the winter turned to spring with the gales of spring, Brenda's sister came to collect Brenda's things from the unoccupied cottage, where there was no longer a dark red motor car. Collecting the dead person's things. It was like something from the old world, an aspect of the idea of sanctity, an aspect of decent burial, the honouring of the dead. And it seemed to call for some ritual, but there was none. The coming for the dead woman's things was matter of fact. I wouldn't have known about it if I wasn't in the kitchen of the manor, settling some little bill with Mrs. Phillips, when Brenda's sister came to call. Mrs. Phillips knew Brenda's sister. It was another indication of the Phillips's town life, their life outside the manor and the village. Mrs. Phillips became much graver when Brenda's sister said what she had come for. I was moved, myself. And we all went, after introductions, to Mrs. Phillips's sitting-room, with its view of the down and the river, the water meadows and the big aspens of the garden, the old stone terrace, the urns, the moss, the mottled stone, the seed bells for the birds, the lines of washing, the mixture of big house garden and backyard domesticity which I had seen through rain and mist on my first day in the grounds when, hardly knowing where I was or understanding what I saw, I had called on the Phillipses. Thereafter I had seen that view only at Christmas time, those years when I was not abroad, when I called on the Phillipses to give them my presents. Brenda's sister was not immediately like Brenda. She was older, fatter. There was a quality in the fatness, the pufferness, which suggested illness, a clinical condition, rather than grossness. Brenda's heaviness in hips and thighs had been different. It had suggested someone spoilt, someone who felt that her beauty entitled her to luxurious sensations and felt at the same time that her beauty could support a certain amount of self-indulgence. But then I began to see Brenda's full lips and wild eyes in her sister's face, saw those features lost or altered in puffy flesh, saw, too, the smoothness of skin and purity of complexion, which would have given the girl, when she was a girl, a high idea of herself and her potential, but which was now part of the breathy wreck she had become. Things had not gone well for these sisters. In different ways, their gift of beauty had turned out to be a torment for them. Brenda's sister lived in a small, newish town to the south, between Salisbury and Bournemouth, not town, not country, not the sort of desolate place she had thought she would end up in. In the Phillips's sitting room it was for a while as though Brenda's sister's call was a purely social one, but then she seemed suddenly to remember what had brought her. She said, "You want to save everything, and then you want to throw everything away." Her voice broke. Her eyes went watery. She left so little. Her clothes. She tried to smile. She was so particular about her clothes. But what can I do about her clothes? No ill will, no anger, no wish for revenge. She said she was too much for him. He couldn't handle her. Mrs. Phillips allowed Brenda's sister to talk on. Brenda's sister said, "She even thought he was queer. Did you know that? She told me he washed his hair every morning. Not in the evening after work, because he didn't want to sleep on it when it was wet, but in the morning. He's like my son Raymond. I hope nobody thinks he is queer because he does that. Raymond does it for the girls at his school." I had always assumed it was Brenda who had encouraged Les to dress up, and had thought that she had chosen things for him. This news about the washing of the hair suggested a lonelier and more desperate man. Brenda's sister said she expected so much from her life. "My mother drilled it into us how much she suffered before the war, living in a little army house, hoping for great things to happen to my father, and that was all that ever happened to us. We lived in a little army house." The story she told us was that her father, a simple serviceman with some factory experience, had had a fleeting moment of inspiration early in the war. He had hit on a new way of mounting guns in the tail of an airplane. And from being a simple serviceman, he had been taken up by the authorities for a few months. He was not alone, though. There were many others like him, men with ideas. Always he was on his way to Ministry of Defence. "Ministry of Defence, Ministry of Defence." I heard those words all the time. When I see the advertisements in the paper today and see the same words, it brings it back. I didn't think she was romancing. Her use of the words "Ministry of Defence," without the definite article, the that the average person would have wanted to add, was convincing. It suggested that she knew the words as well as she had said. But nothing had happened to her father. Guns were changed, aircraft were modified or replaced, and the serviceman had become ordinary again. But his daughters had inherited through their mother a dream of glory, together with a general pessimism, a wishing to hope, and a nervousness about hoping. It made for temperament, frustration, self-destructiveness. It is as if we all carry in our make-up the effects of accidents that have befallen our ancestors, as if we are in many ways programmed before we are born, our lives half outlined for us. Brenda's sister said, "I can't talk. I didn't do so well myself." She had married a builder who, when she had at last got out into the world, got away from the little army house, had seemed to her immensely prosperous and stylish, but had then seemed less so, had fallen on hard times, had done even worse when, trying to change his luck, he had set up in business in Germany, and had then been unfaithful with a younger woman, as glamoured by his manner as Brenda's sister once had been. He had finally left home, left his wife and child. An old story. That was what Brenda's sister said, and that was the way she told it, playing down the drama. As usual, Muggins was the last to know. All her care now was for her son. He was her sole interest. She had narrowed herself down to that. So, though she didn't make the point, there was a pattern to her life. Her father had been replaced by her husband, and her husband by her son. Her life had repeated. She had lived the same life, or versions of the same life, or, looking at it another way, almost as soon as it had begun, a life of choice and passion had ended, as it had ended for her father, her mother, and possibly for generations of her ancestors. All Brenda's sisters' talk of herself came out without prompting, and her hysteria became noticeable. So it was possible, after her early calmness, even formality, in Mrs. Phillips's sitting-room, with the grand view, to see Brenda's sister as an ill person, someone more marked than Brenda had been by their family past, the past that had really been the absence of a great event. And it was possible, at the same time, to see in her not only more and more reminders of Brenda's looks, but also something like another side of Brenda's passions. Such varied passions, so many roots, so little understood, even by the people who had become victims of those passions. Then the hysterical woman with the still smooth skin, the still unblotched colour, remembered her social graces. The call was over. She had to do what she had come to do, collect the things of her sister, who had left so little behind. We left the sitting room, a corridor, thick walls, stone mullions in the window, a door to the big kitchen, and there at the portico Mrs. Phillips said goodbye. When we were out of the manor courtyard and on the rough, stony drive, Brenda's sister said, and it was sudden after her apparent trustingness in the sitting room, "I don't think I will ever forgive Mrs. Phillips." She was distressed. I began to walk with her to the road. As we walked below the yews, she told me of Brenda's flight to Italy. Michael Allen had gone by air. Brenda had gone by train. During that journey, hearing so little English, talking so little to people, she had thought a lot about what she was doing, and she had become afraid. By the time she reached Rome, she had decided not to go to Michael. She thought she would go and stay at a hotel and get a message to Leslie, even send for him. She had a little money. Enough for a few days. She booked into a hotel near the railway station. There was no telephone at home, in the thatched cottage, so she had telephoned the manor and asked for a message to be passed on to Leslie. Nothing had happened. No word came from Leslie. Then, swallowing her pride, because there had been some quarrel between them, Brenda had telephoned the people in Jack's old cottage, the woman who drove fast up the hill in her motor car to collect her children from the school bus every weekday afternoon, and had never smiled at me, the woman who had levelled Jack's garden. But still no message came from Leslie. By this time Brenda's money had run out. She had then done what she had decided not to do. She had gone after all to Michael Allen, and had been with him until, as we had all been told, he had kicked her out. She had come back aggrieved, angry, in a mood to taunt the man she regarded or pretended to regard as a queer, not fully a man. She felt mocked by the romantic impulse that had thrilled and sustained her for a while in the hotel near the railway station in Rome, the girl in need, the girl in danger, the lover eager at the other end. Leslie should have done everything, sold everything, to go to her, but there had been no word from Leslie. Brenda's sister said, "Mrs. Phillips never passed a message to Leslie. She did it 4 or 5 days later, when Brenda had left the hotel and was with Michael. She said she forgot. She said other things came up. She said she didn't think it was all that important. But I think it was deliberate." From the woman who lived in Jack's old house, Brenda's sister said she didn't expect anything. But this story gave a new character to the woman, and the shape and colour of her car, racing up the hill to meet her young children off the afternoon school bus. One day, late in the summer, walking past the old farm buildings and what had been Jack's cottage and garden, the junk and ruins which had formed no part of Jack's vision of a world ever renewed, ruins to which now, across the driveway, was added a burning pit in the chalk for industrial-looking rubbish, the fire of which occasionally singed the silver birches planted years before to screen the old patch of waste ground, one day, walking past the farm and its spreading litter and on up to where the Swiss rolls of hay had been stacked and were already going black and brilliant green with new shoots of grass, I heard the sound of a great fire behind the young wood, and that wood was no longer so young. I heard the sound behind the trees, saw the smoke, and between the black of the tree trunks, the flames in the field beyond, the heat waves distorting the view like a pane of old-fashioned glass. Felt the heat, and then very quickly was engulfed by the noise, rising fast to an amazing crepitation, and I thought of another sound I had heard more than 25 years before, in the highlands of northeastern South America. The sound of a big waterfall. Water, fire. In great disturbance they made the same sound. And fleetingly to me, walking on the downs in that overpowering noise, it seemed that all matter was one. On the way back, the fire quickly burnt away, finished, ashes in the field behind the wood. On the way back from my walk, then and afterwards, the thick patch of moss below the dormer window on the thatched roof of the empty house, a green that was shining, unnatural, that green, once part of the beauty of thatch, seemed to stand for more than vegetable matter. So quiet the thatched house now, so ruined the little garden, once neat, with its hedge, scores of small roses in the summer. And so quiet, over the hill on the other side, at the bottom of the valley, where an old grassed-over field track led to a small abandoned farm building, all black and rust in a little dip in the land, so quiet when I saw them on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, in the silence of the empty downs. The children from what had been Jack's cottage, playing amid the rubble, whitening, sprouting a few weeds with yellow flowers, and the tires of a silage pit. And there, perhaps, Jack's vision of the valley as a whole place would continue, a vision without the decadence that was in my eye, a vision of childhood that would expand in the adult mind. There were others who saw the valley and drove away as a place without decay, walking one day past the old farm buildings, past the fresh litter below the birch trees, the fire in the chalk pit, turning up towards the new wood, I saw a figure in the distance. I was used to solitude on the walk, the sight of a person in the distance like this, with the prospect of an encounter 10 or 15 minutes ahead, could spoil all the intervening walk, and the walk back as well, because the person encountered would be likely to be walking back himself, usually to a parked car at the far end of the driveway, where it met one of the highways. I preferred, therefore, if I saw a person approaching, to give up the walk and turn back. This time, however, I didn't. The person I was walking towards turned out to be a middle-aged woman. She was quite small. In the distance, and especially when seen against the sky, she had seemed physically imposing. People stood out in the emptiness. Her greeting just before we crossed was easy, open. We stopped and spoke. She was a working woman from Shrewton. When she lived at Amesbury, she said, she had regularly done the walk we were both doing now. She'd come out now to look for the deer. So we had that in common as well. She said she had worked out the circuit of the deer. She knew roughly where they crossed the public road. And it was extraordinary, the survival of the family of deer in a piece of land bounded on three sides by busy highways, and on one of those sides in addition by the army firing ranges. No decay in that woman's eye. Downs, walks, deer. The wonder of the natural world, as available as it had always been. And no decay in the eye of the old farm manager either. I saw him one day on a horse on the rising stretch of the driveway between the wood on one side and a treeless field or pasture on the other, before the hill with the larks and the barrows on the brow of the hill. In the old days he had seldom come so far on his inspection tours in his Land Rover, but now he was retired and could roam, and he was on a horse, a further sign of leisure. It was a big horse, of a beautiful colour, white or grey, spotted or spattered with red-brown. It was a difficult horse, he said. It was the gift of his daughter, who had married and gone to live in Gloucestershire. And that was what his talk was about. His daughter, so good with horses, and her gift of the horse. No trouble to her, that animal. His suburban house, at the very edge of the antique driveway. His neat garden. His daughter grown up and gone away. And now the empty day. How quickly his time had passed. How quickly a man's time passed. So quickly, in fact, that it was possible within a normal span to witness, to comprehend, 2 or 3 active life cycles in succession. That wasn't what I thought about when I met him. When I met him on the horse that he was finding so difficult, he dismounted, with some relief, to talk to me. I thought at first only that it was true what some people said. That people who retired after active or physically energetic lives aged fast. He had aged. He had become bent. His walk was stiff. the walk in which, when I had first seen him and thought him to be an exemplar of a farmer type, I had seen a farmer's walk. The other thought, about the shortness of a man's active cycle, his doing period, came to me afterwards, when I had left the manor and my cottage, when that section of my life had closed, and I had begun to feel myself that energy and action were things no longer absolutely at my command, that everyone had been given his particular measure of energy, and that when it was used up, it was used up. These thoughts came to me not many years after.